Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, good friend of the program, Matthew Penny, is in the building. And as we speak, his beautiful, glorious Boston Celtics have just moved into first place in the Eastern Conference. What up, Ben? How you feeling?
I remember when people wanted to blow it up, we said, just slow down a little bit. I know we're so reactionary, but people want to trade Jaylen Brown. Just a few tweaks here and there. I think Derek White's helped a lot, but we didn't have to jump off the ship yet. Just give some time. Give some patience. First time GM, first time head coach of this team. Let's slow down. They did. Luckily, we didn't trade away all our assets and blow up the two J's. And hey, look at here. We're in first place. Look at us.
And look, like at the midseason point, I was like, they should like not blow it up. Like I didn't want them to trade Jaylen Jason. Like that was fucking crazy. But I thought that they should like move Marcus Smart potentially.
Yeah, it seemed like that way. It seemed like that way for a lot of people. And somehow it's worked and coexisted with the Derek White move. And maybe it's moving Josh Richardson. You move Romeo Langford. Guys have been better, a little bit more efficient. Just the ball movement is so.
Well, that's
what Derek White. It's glaring like the change of what it is. Yeah. Like that, just the extra pass or possession because it became so one-on-one dependent, ISO dependent. And there just seems to be. I also don't know if it was just the tide turned with like the offense, the defense, and Ime's sets and guys actually gelling, meshing at the right time. Not complaining. Whatever it is, it's working.
Yeah. And then Derek White gets there. It seems like they play Grant Williams a little bit more now, and he helps with the ball movement.
Yeah.
And with shooting, obviously, now, because Grant can really shoot.
And rookie Peyton Pritchard's back, too, which is crazy. Like, he's on a stretch of hitting three threes a game and how many the last whatever.
It's just, like, a more well-structured offense now. We knew that they could defend. I mean, look, a month and a half ago, I was like, I think this team's going to win two playoff series. Like, I was in. Basically, as soon as this little streak started, I didn't expect them to be in first place in the Eastern Conference. I'll say that.
You didn't expect to say maybe three series, maybe four. I don't know. I don't know how crazy it
was. Yeah, like, look, literally, my bold prediction was when they were in, like, the sixth spot in the Eastern Conference, and I was like, this team's going to win two playoff series. And people were like, you're crazy. Like, no way that's going to happen. And I was like, I'm telling you, this team's going to be really fucking miserable to match up with in the playoffs. And I think that we're closing in on the point where it looks pretty clear that they're going to be really hard to play in the playoffs. So
part of this is just have all the takes. That my new take is have all the takes, because when I saw Villanova play at Mohegan Sun at the Hall of Fame tournament in like November, I texted a buddy who went there. I said, that's a Final Four team, right? I should have just tweeted it, and then you can just like dust it off. They were not Final Four team the middle of the year, and I text the same person. I'm like, I think I made a mistake. Like, this is not it. This is not a Final Four team. But if I had it out there in the public sphere, I could have just retweeted and acted like I was a genius. But it's a long season in the NBA. It's a long season in college. Team hit their strides at different times, and we're seeing now the blue bloods, and the Celtics are an NBA blue blood, are hitting theirs at similar patterns and fashions.
So let's talk about the Blue Blood Final Four. Today on the show, we're going to be talking mostly college basketball and mostly the NCAA tournament, which has gotten down to four teams left. As John Calipari will tell you, there are four remaining in the NCAA tournament. They are Duke, they are Kansas, they are North Carolina, and they are the aforementioned Villanova Wildcats. Both Matt and I are going to be down in New Orleans, and I am very worried about what that city is going to look like. It survived a Kentucky-Louisville Final Four about 10 years ago. It'll survive Duke-North Carolina Final Four, but
it's going to be bad. And I mean the good sense, because also let's set the stage a little bit. This is the first Final Four in like 3 years, which is like an actual in-person Final Four. And for people that aren't familiar with it, it's not just the games. It's also the national like coaching convention. So every coach at every level, for the most part, call it, I don't know, 70-80% of coaches are there in town. They get their pass to actually go now and be out. It's like, wow, we're back at the Final Four. It's like when you get together with your buddies for like a road trip, you haven't seen them in 2 years. Like, oh, this is the best. We should do this every 6 months, start pulling off dates. It never works. But when you actually get there, and the last time I was at the Final Four, it was Kentucky, Louisville, Kansas, and Ohio State. and we had a hotel room. I made a mistake. Our mutual friend made a mistake. We had a hotel on Bourbon Street, which was like, this is great. This is perfect. What you failed to remember or understand was that the when people say, oh, the party doesn't stop, it legitimately like does not stop till like 4 or 5 in the morning. And then they come down the streets with these big like Zambonis and spray like lemon mist and like spray down the streets. And 3 hours later, the music's starting again. So I've made the veteran play. I'm staying about 3 streets away from that.
Yeah, that's what I did.
I like the David and Goliath matchups. When you have 4 Goliaths, the one good thing is the fan bases travel, and they travel really well. That city's going to be packed, and they're just like no escape. And there's going to be like all these storylines from everywhere. I'm sure the networks are happy. We're happy. And it kind of played out. I don't know about you. Of the Elite Eight, I had 4 of those teams losing in the first round in Houston, Miami, St. Peter's, and North Carolina. And now it's kind of like it's brought me back a little bit, but I don't think I had any of these teams in the Final Four either. So if you think we're bad about the drafts, I'm just as bad about college basketball. I could smell the bad decisions brewing in New Orleans, but I'm very, very excited to get there.
Yeah, who did I have in the Final Four? I did not have Villanova because that was Arizona's region. I did not have Duke because I had Texas Tech in that region. I think I did have Kansas because I thought that Midwest region was just like kind of a mess.
Yeah, it's in Auburn, right? Yeah, that's our region. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good call there.
And then I don't think I had North Carolina for sure. I had North Carolina going out in the second round, I believe, to Baylor. So, like, it's just nuts. This is it's an unexpected Final Four of Blue Bloods, which is weird. Like, it's strange that we feel like we can craft this weird underdog narrative for North Carolina,
right?
Despite the fact that they're fucking North Carolina.
Yeah.
Like, they're an 8 seed. They have. Okay, like 1.5 pros. Let's set the over under at 1.5 pros.
It's a good line.
Play in the NBA.
Yeah, I mean, if Brady Manek plays like he did this week, yeah, he's a lottery pick. I don't know if that continues. If Caleb Love shoots 6 for 13 from 3 as he did in 2 of the 4 games, yeah, he'll make it. But that's a good line. We did what a year ago the episode on what we thought the best jobs in college basketball were. I think we had North Carolina like 2. Or 3. Yeah. I think it was like Kentucky, Carolina, Kansas, somewhere there. And somehow this underdog narrative has happened, which is okay. And you set up this ultimate rubber match with Duke for all the marbles during the Coach K farewell tour. It's just strange how we've gotten here, but it fits a season of basketball and college basketball. We're still just trying to make sense of everything. And we're heading to the Final Four.
And let's start with Duke because Duke probably has the over-under is 5.5 pros on this team. And it's interesting because we've seen good Paolo Banchero. I don't think we've seen like standout, outstanding Paolo Banchero. The only time that he's really dusted that off, I felt like, was in the game against Texas Tech. He was really good in that game. I don't know if he was like no doubter top 3 pick in the draft. Amazing, but he was really good. We didn't really get any of the elite level prospects, like the top 4 guys in this class, that had these crazy standout games in big spots. Like Chet Holmgren and Jabari Smith both had great games in their opener against 16 and 15 seeds.
Right.
But like Chet was not amazing in the tournament. Jabari Smith was bad in their game against Miami. Paolo has had one like really truly good game and then a bunch of like good games, solid games. Jaden Ivey was a disaster. Like
we'll get there.
Disaster. Yeah. 3 syllables all across the board against St. Peter's in that game. Oh my God, what a mess was he. Like it wasn't even just how poorly he played, it was the body language and stuff, and we'll talk about him in a minute. But like it feels like we outside of maybe even the Ben Mathurin performance against TCU, which was genuinely incredible, and he like willed that team to victory. We didn't really get a great Keegan Murray performance in the NCAA tournament because he went 21-9 and out, if I remember correctly. We didn't get a great Jeremy Sohan performance, although I thought he was pretty good in their loss to North Carolina. We didn't get a great Jalen Duren performance. Johnny Davis, even in that game against Colgate where he dropped 25 points, like he took 22 shots to get there. The guy that has probably impressed most, I would say, and this is a guy that you wanted to talk about, was Mark Williams. Like, I think Mark Williams has maybe moved the needle more, which is something that you brought up on the last podcast. Mark Williams has maybe moved the needle more for his draft stock than any player, I think, in the NCAA tournament so far.
Isn't part of it just him being Mark Williams, too? Like, I don't think he tried to do anything outside of his comfort zone. This is what it sort of was all year long, and I was wrong, and I'll say that a lot. I'm going to say a lot this episode. Last year, when he had that double-double stretch at the end of the year when Jalen Johnson was out, I thought that was sort of like a byproduct of nobody can score. Let me put him on my back, do what I can. I didn't think when the haul of the freshman class that came in, I didn't think he'd have the same type of production. Sometimes those guys just like fade back once more guys get in there, sort of like Garrison Brooks did in North Carolina, right? Like we projected this crazy year, more guys came in, better guards, it faded away. He hasn't changed. Like the motor still stays on a million miles per hour at all times. And it's all like the micro skills and these like little plays where he keeps plays alive on kickouts and he dives on the floor. He changes ends. He finishes lobs. There's one stretch in that Arkansas game where he's scoring like an and one, comes down the other end, strips the ball away. It's a hustle play. He like advances it. Somebody misses it. He comes up behind him and finishes and tips it in. And he did like back-to-back plays. Like that's an NBA five. He had his way with Jalen Williams, in my opinion. We'll talk about that. He blocked at the rim. He powered through him. So I posed on Twitter.
At the basket, I agree with you totally. He had his way with him at the basket.
And people are very upset with me. When I said, let's just have the conversation. Let's not get too crazy right now. Is it a conversation now with between us, between scouts, between NBA teams, of Jalen Duren or Mark Williams? And my argument, and you only get so many characters on Twitter, and people go nuts and say you're an idiot, and that's fine. I can embrace that. My point is taking Mark Williams at, say, 15 to 18 may have more benefit than Jalen Duren at 8. You have a better idea of role, of scalability, of how he's going to fit in an offense. Where you said, how many pros does Duke have right now? 4 or 5? He's fine being the fifth guy, and it's not like a drop-off for him to be the first guy like he was last season, or pick up the pieces and be like the best defensive player on the team around Paolo Banchero, helping AJ Griffin, protect the rim when Roach gets burnt. I've been even more impressed than I was. We've kind of been on this train for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and now I feel like we've really taken off from the station.
Yeah, no, look, it's interesting because I feel like I've been higher on Mark the whole year than what the consensus was. Like I had him as a top 20 guy. Like I look back at the last mock draft I did and I had him at 15.
Yeah,
I think it's appropriate. A month ago. Like, so me moving him up to 11 or 12, like it's not that big of a move. You know what I mean? It's just like, hey, this is where this guy is. I mean, look, like I have Mark Williams at 12, I think. I have Jalen Duren at 9. I think it's an entirely appropriate conversation to have. I don't know that I would take Mark Williams over Jalen Duren. I don't think I would, if we're being completely honest. But I think it's an appropriate conversation because the level to which Mark Williams is a more solid defender at the basket in terms of his ability to rotate across, contest everything at the rim, use the principle of verticality without fouling. I think there's this idea out there that Jalen Williams is this like potential, I don't even want to say switch defender because I don't think people see that necessarily. But I do think that they see him as like, oh, you can do some like different stuff in ball screens with him. Maybe long term, but I mean, his feet are pretty heavy right now.
Yeah.
Like in his, I think it's more of a footwork thing than a lack of lateral speed thing. Like I think that his feet kind of get off kilter and he has to make these like kind of lunging moves at times to kind of get himself back in position. We saw that with the fourth foul in their tournament game against Gonzaga, where he picks up this foul on Drew Timmy. He gets himself like in a bad spot and it's against Timmy because his footwork is absolutely outstanding. And he ends up having to take like this big stride step and like bump him. And it was an obvious foul call and you had to call it, right? So from a tools perspective, though, we're not talking about a situation here where there's a drastic difference.
Right.
Like Mark Williams is like 7 foot, 7 foot one with a 7 foot six, I don't know, wingspan. Hasn't been measured yet officially, I don't think. But, you know, I've heard anywhere from 7 foot five to 7 foot seven. So, like, let's go in the middle there, I think, right? Jalen Duren is like 6 foot 11 with a 7 foot five wingspan. Certainly terrific in terms of measurements. I think Mark Williams is just as explosive in terms of being maybe just as explosive in terms of quickness off the ground, but not as powerfully explosive, in that he doesn't really go through guys necessarily in the same way Jalen Duren does. The thing that worries me a little bit with Mark is the thing where you mentioned that Jalen Williams, you thought, like, got beasted in that game. I thought Jalen took advantage of him pretty drastically away from the basket. I think that Mark's positioning, more than even his foot, more than like even his like lack of foot speed and everything, I think Mark's positioning could stand to improve in ball screen coverages. I don't think he's all that effective yet playing as a drop coverage defender. But you know what? Like, Duke makes it work around him. I think that that's the reason that I would have Walker Kessler ahead of Mark Williams for National Defensive Player of the Year. And it's just like a little, it's a little thing that Mark Williams, I think, can improve in long term. I think Mark Williams is going to be great defensively in the NBA. But like our mutual friend brought up the name Jared Allen with Mark Williams. And I don't think that's wrong. Like I see a lot of that with him. He has great hands. He's really effective contesting around the basket, blocks shots at a really high level, great rebounder, great offensive rebounder as well. The tools are there. Like I think Mark Williams should be a lottery pick at this point. Just given what the back end of the lottery looks like, I think we should be considering Mark Williams a lottery pick. And I wanted to kind of ask you this question because I know that you have interesting takes about this other guy that are worth exploring a little bit. Is there a case that Mark Williams is Duke's second best prospect?
There's a case. There's definitely a case. It's part of the discussion too. Every year there's a few guys that us folks in draft Twitter just put our arms around, like, how dare you? You can't speak about Jalen Duren that way. You can't speak about AJ Griffin that way. And those are two very polarizing guys out there. I see the pros and cons in both. If we're saying Mark Williams could potentially be Jared Allen, I'm fine taking an all-star 12th overall. No issue with that. My kind of throwback to you before we dive into the next player here is, how much does age factor into sort of your slotting? Because what I did get yelled at a lot about was Jalen Duren is 2 years younger, and he should be a senior in high school. And that still, like, the progression may be different. Like, in 2 years, what does he look like playing at Duke with four pros? Does that look any different to you? Do you factor that into saying, well, he's three spots ahead, despite Mark Williams being where he is now? Is that leap going to happen? Is it inevitable? Is that why we have Keegan Murray slotted behind Paolo Banchero, because he is 2 years older? Like, how does that work for you?
It's a good question. I think for me, it does matter to an extent. I do think that Jalen Duren reached his like physical prime just quicker in his life than Mark Williams did. Whereas Mark Williams, I mean, you saw him in high school. I saw him in high school. I saw him multiple times at multiple camps. He was like painfully, dreadfully skinny when he was in high school. Like, couldn't do anything, it felt like. Couldn't really, like, got moved around constantly.
Yes. And as an add-on to that, I actually had the picture pulled up. I have it here for those who see. His front line at IMG Academy, and granted, there's a transfer in here, but just this is the practice every day they had. Jalen Johnson, professional. Lynn Kidd, his 7 feet tall at Virginia Tech. Brandon Huntley Hatfield, 6'10", 6'11", at Tennessee.
Yeah.
Zach Edey, 7'4", at Purdue. Musa Diabate, 6'10", at Michigan. And Mark Williams. So he was also kind of a situation of iron sharpens iron there, that, like, you saw the piece around him. You talked to coaches, the same thing with Zach Edey. He saw what the work was of Jeremiah Robinson Earl the year before and said, I want to be that guy. So when you put all those guys together, and credit to IMG Academy and their strength and conditioning program, but you're right, it took time for Mark to kind of catch up with some of the physicality too.
Yeah, so I think that when you're looking at developmental trajectories, you have to consider not just age, but like the actual progression that they've been on, right? And in the case of Jalen, like, Jalen was 6'11", 240 pounds, what, from the time he was 16?
Sure.
Something like that. Yeah. He just developed quicker. And Mark developed, you know, along a more natural, I guess, progression. And it does matter to me that Jalen Duren is 2 years younger from a polished perspective, because a lot of what I just mentioned with Jalen was polish, like footwork and things like that, that I think he needs to clean up. Additionally, what matters to me with Jalen is that he is surrounded by a total and a complete and utter lack of point guard play, right, at Memphis. Absolutely. It took until like the last six games of the year until Alex Lomax like figured some things out, right, and made it work. So it matters to me. It's why I would have Jalen Duren right now without having like completely and totally dug back into the tape to like make sure of this. I do want to like really dig into Jalen Duren's tape at some point here. I would have Jalen Duren slightly ahead, but I think they're in like the same conversation area.
Yeah.
During the draft. And I don't think that's a crazy question to ask, because we're talking about two guys. Mark Williams is a little bit taller. He has just as much length. He has real explosiveness, real shot blocking capabilities. He's a better positional defender. I don't think that Jalen Duren's tools like drastically exceed Mark Williams's tools. Do you?
No. And Mark Williams, it's also like, it's a nasty game, like ripping rebounds over the top, blocking shots, running, taking off. There's never times when I'm like, ooh, he took a few plays off there. He might be out of position. Yeah. He might be pulled out and his footwork might be wrong on the perimeter, but he's going to sprint back the town the other way. And I don't want to shortchange Jalen Duren either. He's a very good prospect. I don't want this to come off that way.
This is more about Mark Williams.
Not about Jalen Duren
being a lottery pick.
We also get so far ahead of ourselves. When Mark Williams hit that 1 foot fadeaway jumper like 2 rounds ago at the end of shot clock, I said, ooh, wonder if that's a thing. And then it's burned in my brain. You see Jalen Duren against Chet kind of like clank off like a mid-range jumper. And it's one shot. We're not saying like, hey, it's happened 25 times. But if you can tap into that, it's even more appealing. I really like him. He's definitely leapt Walker Kessler for me. I texted a scout today. So what did I miss? I still really like Walker Kessler. I have him as a first round guy. I think Mark Williams is above him for me for sure. It's tools based. I guess so.
Yeah, you have to have him ahead. What did the scout say?
Similarly, just kind of like it. You have to let out more of the season play. Yeah, I know he's SEC Defensive Player of the Year. People gonna be like, "Was this whole season, dummy? Like, what else do you have to see?" But the more you sort of dig back into the tape too, just more of the physicality, the physical nature that Mark Williams is too. And I just think you can plop him into any team. Not like, oh, it doesn't really work in Sacramento. You know what? That's better in Orlando than it would be Houston. Like, nah, that's one of these guys that's drafted. You throw him on a team, put four guys around him, he's going to be fine. He's going to survive.
Yeah, I totally agree. To get back to my original question, is there a case for him over AJ Griffin?
There's a case. I'd say probably not draft wise, but there's definitely a case.
So I would definitely take AJ Griffin ahead. Yeah. Right. I think the shooting,
it's a conversation though, right? It's a conversation. We're not like hard stop.
Yeah. I will say, I don't think AJ Griffin looks as athletic as he was before his injuries, and how much of that is still recovery. How much of that is that he is different athletically now. I don't really know. Like, I brought up the name not in terms of what he is actually as a prospect, but just in terms of the way that his athleticism now bears itself out within the half court game. I brought up the name Khalil Whitney to you and our mutual friend during the NCAA tournament, just because it feels like so much of what AJ Griffin has to do in the half court is load based. Like, he has to really load into everything he does in order to get the most out of his explosiveness. And it was the same with Khalil Whitney. The guys that tend to be successful in half court NBA settings are the guys that are a little bit twitchier, a little bit more, what's the word I'm looking for here? Like, their first and second jumps, just they get off the floor faster than guys.
Right.
And I don't think that AJ Griffin has that right now. Is it possible that he's just hurt right now and is still getting back from the injury? Is it possible that it's different? NBA teams are really going to have to like dig into this pre-draft and figure out, because if he's this level athlete, I think he's more of like a late lottery pick. I don't think he's like in the mix to go 5 or 6. But if he is, like, if he has a shot to get back to that level of athleticism, you take him 5 or 6, no question, and you just don't look back, because his shooting and his touch is unbelievable at this point still.
Right. So that's my next point, is that he's still, despite all this stuff, he's still shooting 50% from the field, 46% from three. And when he does shoot that way, it's such a difference maker. He had a nasty step back early in that Texas Tech game. And then being that threat, Texas Tech had to close out so hard. And it's like they ran that elevator play where they close out hard to him. Paolo and Mark Williams slipped, and they just kind of could do what they want. Like, when he's that type of guy, there's true value into it. Him being a semi-non-athlete is weird to me. Like, he went baseline one play and got, like, blocked at the rim. He doesn't really get true separation off the dribble. And he's, like, slow. Then defensively, slow to rotate. He was bailed out once when he used his length to, like, block a guy that clearly had a step on him. So I don't know. I can't, like, shake it. He had another awkward, like, one-on-one on the break where you thought, oh, he's going to jump and try to, like, throw at the rim. It's like a Euro step until, like, he turned around and passed it backwards. It's like, I don't – what are you doing? But he has really soft touch, and you keep him a threat offensively when he cuts and gets in a lane, and he's able to use his size to still extend. Like, he was cut off last game and kind of spun around and just shot over the top of people. I love when he keeps it simple, just catch and shoot. One pump fake, one dribble. When he starts trying to get into his bag, like, there's just not that separation or burst off there either. Yeah. So I'm hoping it's injury, but I don't know. It's been a long time to say, hey, it's still the ankle or whatever it may be.
Yeah, it's that's the thing. It has been a while now. And look, he did have the knee injury in the preseason. Like, maybe that set him back, and he hasn't been able to, like, do the strength based rehab work to, like, bring that back. Right? I don't know. I just don't know is kind of where I'm at with AJ Griffin. And if we find out in the pre-draft process that, like, you know, that there are concerns about what he looks like long-term, then I do think that this is a real conversation between him and Mark Williams on who is Duke's number two prospect. We just spent 25 minutes talking about Duke, though. Do you have any other strong opinions you want to get off your chest before we move on? Because I have one more, and I'll give you the floor.
My one strong opinion is we do have to give Paolo Banchero his due. He looked like point forward Paolo at times out there against Texas Tech. Yeah. When he threw that alley-oop little lob to Mark Williams, he was making plays off the dribble, a little bit less of the hesitation off ball reversals. He still had one early last game against Arkansas when it got to him. It was beautiful basketball. It was like three ball reversals. It got to him. He's like, I'm going to dribble. And then he dribbled and then, like, got back to me, shot it again. Just shoot the first one. We've said it a million times. So when he's clicking and not overthinking, he looked really, really good out there.
Yeah. No, I agree. The thing that I want to bring up is that I've been hard on Coach K throughout the year. I don't think he's been awesome. I don't think he's put this team in position to succeed throughout the regular season at the level that it was possible that it could have. I've said throughout the season, I thought this was by far the most talented team in college basketball, who had the highest ceiling in college basketball, and they weren't reaching it. And I felt that they weren't reaching it in part because of some of the things that Coach K was doing defensively, some of the things Coach K was doing in terms of letting the guards just kind of have free rein to do what they want when they aren't good enough decision makers to really be allowed to do that. They stuck with Jeremy Roach throughout the year. Jeremy Roach looks like a potential, like, 2023 second round pick, something like that. Sure. Looks like a guy that could end up in the NBA at one point. They've really started to run the offense through Paolo Banchero more. He's dialed up his own defense twice now in the last two games that has been critical to their success, completely flummoxed the other team in terms of the way that they run offense. I think we really have to give Coach K his props. I think he's been outstanding in this tournament so far, just in terms of adjusting to the way the defense is playing Duke and making adjustments on his team's behalf to put them in better positions to succeed.
Yeah, wild. When they had the Coach K night where North Carolina beat their socks off, and I remember him saying they did everything about, like, five national championships, right? And the crowd was chanting, six, six. We're like, where, man? Like, what are you talking? You just got boat raced at home by North Carolina. Like, this team's going to be out in the first round or two. But they actually bounced back. It took a little bit longer than we thought. And they've been really good. They're in the Final Four and set up with a nice situation scenario for him to go out on top. And, yeah, credit where it's due. I was never going to take shots at Coach K. That's why it's your show and not mine. But he's righted the ship.
Yeah, no, he's done a really good job. Let's take a quick commercial break, and we're going to talk about the other three Final Four teams, because they are interesting in their own right, as well as some other prospect stuff. Okay, we are back here at the Game Theory Podcast, and we want to talk about some of the other teams that made the Final Four. Villanova is in the Final Four. You mentioned earlier that, you know, you thought this was a Final Four team when you saw the Mohegan Sun.
Yeah,
I thought they looked great. Like, by the time January rolled around, I thought that they'd kind of righted the ship with their defense. Their guard play has been outstanding since that point. Unfortunately, Justin Moore is going to miss the Final Four and, like, probably most of next year, it feels like, due to the fact that he just tore his Achilles. It's a real shame. It sucks that he's now going to have to go through what is one of the most difficult rehabs in all of sports. And now Villanova is in the Final Four, and they're going to have to rely on Jermaine Samuels and Colin Gillespie and Brandon Slater and all of the inherent intrinsic Villanova-ness of it all that they instill these players with.
Just jump stops, shot fakes, do whatever you can. Just keep going until they go and lean in. And those guys are unreal. Like, the player development staff there is unreal. I mean, Jermaine Samuels is from Boston. He played around here. I watched him a lot. I never thought that this would be the player Jermaine Samuels turned out to be. And I mean, that's a compliment. Just completely bought into the Villanova way and system. He had 16 points and 10 rebounds in that last game. And the one kind of prospect-y question, and because this is a draft show, more or less, right? I've gotten this question a lot. Is Colin Gillespie an NBA player?
I think he plays NBA games. I don't know if he's like an NBA difference maker, but
no, I wouldn't say difference maker, but is he on a roster? Is he probably an undrafted free agent, right? Like, let's not go too nuts here, but I see him as a summer league guy. You see if you get to training camp, what he can do. And sometimes those are hits. And sometimes we get too crazy and say, well, Villanova is really good. Like, he's the engine behind the whole thing. How is he not an NBA player? And the good thing is people have kind of changed their direction of how they're hitting you. It's not, why isn't he a lottery pick? Which, like, 2 years ago, that was like a lot of, like, why isn't Luka Garza a top 10 pick? Well,
let me
count the ways, but he's still on a roster. He's averaging 5 points per game, 3 rebounds, not changing the world, but can Colin Gillespie
why is he not Peyton Pritchard going first round?
And someone actually asked me that exact question. It's just, well, Peyton Pritchard's a significantly better shooter.
Yeah, I think so. I think Peyton just has more shit to him off the bounce. Like, his creativity off the bounce, his handle is just much better. But Colin is a great floor leader. I think he actually can switch a little bit defensively, like, within that scheme.
A little.
He doesn't get
scheme, though. Scheme. That you're absolutely right. That's what it is. It's within the Villanova scheme. You put him on an island, I don't know how great I feel about that.
Yeah, like, he doesn't get obliterated out there whenever he gets, like, mismatched onto a four. Like, if it's a five, he might get put in the basket. But I don't know. Like, fours, like, he can kind of manage them a little bit. I think he's got a shot. Yeah. Like, if he's on a two-way next year, that wouldn't surprise me at all by any stretch of the imagination.
Pre-tournament, where did he kind of check out on your board? Was he in the top 100? Was he knocking on the door? Yeah. Was he? Yeah.
Where do I have him? I have him.
Roughly. Not trying to put you on the spot.
Yeah, I have him at 86 coming into the tournament. That'd probably be about where he is until we know what guys are staying and going in terms of the draft, like who enters the draft, who does not enter the draft. I have Jermaine Samuels, by the way, at, I think I have him somewhere in here. I think I have him at like 90, 95. I don't know. I can't look through it right now. But yeah, like a guy that I think is kind of interesting, like super switchable defensively, has developed at least a little bit of a semblance of a shot. Like, he has a real chance, I think.
Yeah, it's people just want to point that and say, well, TJ McConnell did it. Well, Peyton Pritchard did it. It's like, okay, I get it. You're doing like the, just here's another white guard. Why can't they succeed to similar fashion? I've liked him. I still have my concerns, as I think you do, but it wouldn't like blow me away if somehow he's on a team next year.
Yeah, no.
Or he goes to Europe and crushes and makes a jillion dollars over 20 years.
Yeah, totally. I think that's all I've got on Villanova. We'll see how they look against Kansas. I hope that Justin Moore is able to get back and, you know, play in the 2023-24 season. As we talk here, Kevin McCullough has declared his NBA draft eligibility, but will maintain his collegiate eligibility. I'm a Kevin McCullough fan. I'm going to the mat for Kevin McCullough as a long-term potential NBA player. I don't know that it'll happen for sure, but great defender. I think that he's really hampered this year by the ankle injuries, and I'm interested to see where it goes.
Can initiate a little bit of offense too. It felt like he got to his spots in that last tournament game, draws fouls, had a nice spin and score in the second half of it, had a tough pull up in the lane. This is just like sort of our new normal too. Like everyone's going to declare and keep their eligibility. Like some of them pop it up. I'm like, I don't, like, why are you doing this? I can tell you what it is, right? Like, I'm not even trying to be like a hard L and say, like, I know where everyone's getting drafted, but some of the guys that pop up, it's like, yeah, dude, you're 75th. Like, just save your time. You're not going to magically be like 31st, and we were way off. We're going to be wrong a lot. But some of those guys, like, I don't see him becoming like the 20th pick overall in the draft, getting guaranteed money this year.
Yeah, like, it's funny. So, like, Trayvon Brazil, we were talking about him earlier before we started recording. Big forward out of Missouri. He has declared for the draft, right? I think that kid's really good. I think he has like first round upside next year if he finds the right spot and ends up in the right situation. He's an incredible shot blocker. He's a late bloomer. He was like a 6'1" junior in high school who has gone up to be like a 6'9" forward now, who's all sorts of twitchy, has great length, can still shoot it a little bit, really needs to hone in on that, needs to hone in on his feel for the game and everything, and just generally like mature into his frame because he just grew 8 inches 2 years ago, right? That kid declared for the draft, and I'm just like, no, just stay in the portal, go find your landing spot. Maybe you're trying to just get like some notoriety from being in the NBA draft pool, but like I think you can do that with the portal now. So if I was like a kid like that, where there are probably teams that are genuinely interested, like I've talked to a couple that are like, oh man, like we'd love to get him into camp.
Yeah, and
like
I've heard the name, I've had similar conversations, but nobody said, hey, this is like a top 30 guy that you guys are way off on, like throw him up there.
No question. So like that's a kid where I'm just like, go back to school. I think you legitimately could be a first round pick. If things go right for you over the next 2 years, do that. So like we're in this world where we're going to have 250 kids declare for the draft and we just have to, you know, kind of work through it. Okay. Let's talk about Kansas because I want to talk about Ochai Agbaji.
Yes.
What is going on with Ochai?
I don't have answers. It's strange. It's a weird time to regress. So against Providence, I thought he was good. Let's do some positives. I thought he was good on defense. So he's a disruptor. He had 3 blocks in the first half. He closed out hard. He rotated well away from the ball. But like the shooting, like he's just taking like sort of wild shots at times. He took 1-3, like kicking his legs out. Another one was like a quick one in transition. He's just not helping his percentage. He's shooting like 25% from 3. In March over 10 games where he went back to school and we were excited because like the shot was there plus the slashing plus the defense plus the body. He hasn't looked like the Big 12 player of the year lottery guy that we were all jacked up about and saying, hey, this guy should go 12th. And then today against Miami, again, it's just weird, like hit a few pull-ups, but for his size and strength, when he gets to the paint, he's not like a strong enough finisher. Like he sort of bails out. Like he doesn't try to like dunk on guys all the time.
I think the problem is he's a load leaper. So like those plays where he gets, you know, Bill Self draws up an incredible like backdoor cut for him and he really explodes off at 2 feet and then throws down like
he did that tomahawk. On the left wing.
Yeah. Like that's the kind of stuff where he looks super impressive, but then you look and you go like, okay, what's going on here? Why can't you finish at the basket? I feel like he needs to work on his craft and footwork off of 1 foot. And it's been well publicized that, you know, he worked with Phil Beckner last year pre-draft. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to confirm that he's going to go work with Phil Beckner for pre-draft this year. I don't know. But if he does, I think that's the stuff that Phil and those guys down in Arizona will really clean up.
He had another weird one where he missed a layup and went out of bounds and then ran back in and hit like a spot 3. And he scored a lot of his points today. And that's why the box score can be deceiving. I think he had 20 points. A lot of it, they're up like 15, 18.
Sure.
Self calls a timeout. They run that backdoor play. He hits 2 threes late. The percentages matter, man. Like when he's an older guy that I've rallied for pretty strongly throughout the year, this is not the time to dip. It doesn't have to be. We'll talk about other draft guys who had like bad performance or two. It's like, it's a little bit of a blip. When there's 5 or 6 of them and you've gone 5 for 14 in two of your tournament games and the Big 12 tournament. He was good. He was bad. He was terrible on senior night. It's like, you got to smooth out. You got to be a sure thing when you're that much older.
Well, here's the thing, Matt. I still can't get him lower than 14.
I know. I can't either. I can't either. And that's why I think I have him right there at 14 or 15. I bumped him down. I had him as high as 10. He never cracked the top 10. Yeah. I had him as high as 10 in like January. Bumped him down a few spots. I'm like, I don't know how much lower I can go than here.
Yeah, like I don't think I can get – I think that genuinely the lowest I could get him is 16. Like, he's like right in that mix with like Tari Ty Washington and Malachi Branham and Mark Williams. Right. But like, I don't know, man.
I have Branham jumping him, but I have him at 14. I have Mark Williams 15, Tari Eason 16, Ty 17.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. The next guy here is Christian Brown.
Yes.
And he has played interestingly throughout the tournament. They've almost used him more as like a passer and playmaker at times, mm-hmm. It feels like, where they've just kind of let Remy Martin kind of take over the offense more and more as he's gotten more and more comfortable. And as they've needed more and more shot creation, especially in that game against Creighton and against who they play in the Providence as well.
Yeah.
In the Sweet 16. Like, they just needed the shot making and they needed the shot creation. And, you know, Oshai and Christian Brown are better out in transition or better as like players off the catch in the half court. It's interesting that they're using like Christian Brown to like play make off the pass a little bit more, I think, in the tournament.
They've played this sort of transition two-man game with him and Oshai, which like one of them will take off, the other one advance it, the other one fall behind. He scores in transition. He had a big three that sent him into timeout. There's a turnover that led to a steal and to an Oshai dunk late in the game. I love Christian Brown's energy. I love the edge that he plays with. When we talk about Remy Martin, and he's kind of coming on here, I do have to get on my soapbox for a sec. It's been turned into this feel-good story, and I'm happy for him. I'm glad it clicked. He was a Big 12 preseason player of the year, and next game, barring something crazy, he's going to score his 2,000th college point. So I don't know if that's just like embarrassment of riches and he finally is like hit the way Kansas basketball wants to play and good for him. But this is sort of like the player, not only us. I mean, this is the player that clearly Big 12 coaches expected to be there all season. And you're glad he's like this secret weapon. But is it really that secret is my question to you.
Yes, because there hasn't been a point this year up until the last like six games within Kansas's offense, which asks its guards to do very specific things, where it's clicked. And part of that is the defensive side. Like, he just isn't good enough defensively. By the way, do you remember when Remy Martin like got all defense team votes in the Pac-12?
you're cut off from talking about any Pac-12 defense awards. After Onyeka didn't win the award, you're cut off.
Yeah, no. There were some
you're cut off from Pac-12 defense and the turn you've taken on block versus charge. You can't talk about those either. Let's stay on Remy. Stay on task. Let's talk Remy right now.
Oh no. Come on. Oh, Matthew. Look, like I think that it's interesting because this is a kind of scheme where you would think that Remy looks pretty good, right? Like, well-spaced floor outside of David McCormick. They play three perimeter players with Jalen Wilson, Ochai Agbaji, Christian Brown next to him. And he's just kind of got this open space to be able to create, like, especially in that mid, like 16 foot range. Right. And that's where he's making a killing right now. And I'm glad he's like, it's hard for me to be anything but happy for these guys that like return to school and then go through adversity and then like struggle through it and then come out on the other side. Like, we'll talk about Caleb Love here in a second, but like Caleb Love has been hit or miss throughout the course of the year. Caleb Love has had a great tournament and I'm super happy for him. It's hard for me to be anything other than that. Like, Remy Martin is not a real NBA prospect, in my opinion. There might be some teams that think differently. I've not talked to them, but I'm not willing to rule it out. I don't think Remy Martin's a real prospect, but I'm super glad that he's getting the success. I'm glad he's getting this moment. I'm glad he's about to drop 2,000 points. I'm glad that he's, you know, the catalyst for Kansas reaching the Final Four. It's great.
I'm not mad. Yeah, it's great. Write your own story, finish your own stuff. Arizona State didn't really work out there. toward the end, and now you're in Final Four. That's why guys go in the transfer portal and try to level up what school they end up at, because they want to be in situations like this where they're trying to cut down nets in New Orleans in a couple days.
Yeah. No, I agree. Okay. Anyone else on Kansas we need to talk about? I feel like I don't really have any other points on the Jayhawks. Finally, North Carolina. The Caleb Love story has been the dominant one, I would say, especially that game against – who did they play in this
one? Well, he hit six threes twice.
Who did they play in the Sweet 16? Because that was the crazy one. That was like the, oh, shit, this is really happening. He is absolutely dominant.
Was it UCLA, that game?
It was UCLA, yes.
Yeah, he's
the reason they beat UCLA.
And he was pointing to the bench saying, like, I got you. I told you I was doing this. And I was texting with fellow media person. I don't consider myself a media person, but I was texting with a media person. I said, man, I thought UCLA had it there. I thought with kind of – and Jaime Jaquez was not 100%, but sort of fullish, healthiest roster. I said, I thought UCLA was going to get over the hump. And the person said to me, North Carolina just hit the shots that UCLA did last tournament. It's just the karma has leveled back off. I mean, do you remember all the daggers during UCLA's run last year were so improbable? And now it's just North Carolina. It was Caleb Love knocking down 6 3-pointers. That wasn't even Brady Manick's best game, but he had 3 threes in that game. And every time it started to get closer, they pulled away with one of those deep, deep range threes.
Yeah, and this is a fun North Carolina team. Like, Brady Manick is a fun story. Like, he looks like he drives, you know, like a pickup truck to and from basketball practice.
Yeah.
You know, he looks like the most basketball player in, like, history since Larry Bird.
If that guy walks into men's league, though, you're like, oh, he's going to give us 30. You can't not be a hooper. Like him, David Roddy. I'm trying to think of my old men's league team from the tournament. I'll get there. But
I'll give you one. Not from the tournament, but Noah Carter, who's in the transfer portal right now from Northern Iowa. Real, like, men's league, 6'6", 240 pound, like, constantly moving, trying to get leverage on a guy, like, trying to seal him away from the post, super fundamental, like, just all that stuff.
Let's add Baylor Shireman too. That, like, when I was first watching them, like, men's, like, kill you. Just, like, you don't pick up. I was screaming at the TV during the Providence game, like, close out. It doesn't matter. He's 29 feet. He's going to shoot and hit it. But for Brady Manick, he does turn 24 in September. He was at Oklahoma. But his run right now, had them losing the first round. Wrong for me. 28 points against Marquette. 10 for 15 from the field, 5 for 10 from 3. Baylor, where he gets chucked for a flagrant 2, but he still had 26 points, 8 for 13 from the field, 4 for 8 from 3. UCLA, we talked about, in St. Peter's, 19 points, 7 for 11 from the field, 4 for 6 from 3. Him spacing out and pulling guys away has helped Armando Bacot be an absolute beast in the post. He had 20-20 today. Helps Caleb Love a little bit off the ball. Helps RJ Davis have more space. When he plays like this, it's such a difference maker in what Carolina's trying to do. They've been way better than I thought they would, clearly, by my terrible prediction. And it set up a nice little grudge match here.
The Pelicans just beat the Lakers after the Lakers were up 20 at halftime take over the 8 spot. Ooh. Or no, take over the 9 spot, I'm sorry, in the play-in tournament. We're at a point where the Lakers now are one game ahead of San Antonio for getting into the play-in tournament.
This is where we make the Lakers series winning time joke, but I'm not going to do that.
Oh, my God. What a mess. What an absolute, absolute mess the Los Angeles Lakers are. Yeah, look, I mean, the fun one to me, too, is Armando Bacot, because, like, he's a really great college player. I have no idea how that's going to work in the NBA. I don't think it is going to work really in the NBA, but he's so effective as a college player that, like, I don't want to rule it out. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm okay with that. I don't want to rule it out either. I don't know how much game he has really, like, outside the paint, but he's been super productive. He's worth noting, worth mentioning. But I don't think anything he does, and rebound always translates, but I don't think anything screams like, hey, this is a late first big.
And he's a little bit longer than, like, what you think in terms of, like, his wingspan. Like, it feels like he gets to shots that he shouldn't as a shot blocker now. I think he's gotten in better shape as well.
Yep.
Like,
yes,
you know, it, throughout, like, I think he was like very heavy when he was in high school, if I remember correctly, right?
Earlier, yeah. But then he,
yeah, like early in high school.
Prep school.
Yeah. And like, I think that even throughout his time at North Carolina, he's gotten much in like much better shape and stronger throughout his like body, it feels like. So I don't know, maybe, but like it's a backup center if it works. But he's a great college player and he dropped 20-20 today against St. Peter's. Shout out St. Peter's. What a great story. But yeah.
Yeah, and arguably ACC player of the year. I don't think he won, but he averaged 12.6 rebounds, which is pretty insane after 7.8 the year before. So he's made that progression. Can we do like 1 minute or 2 minute on St. Peter's real quick?
I will give you the floor on St. Peter's.
I just want to start where this whole St. Peter's run, it felt like a feel-good movie that you don't even believe at some point. Like, do you remember Little Giants, when Little Giants beat the Cowboys and they were on the NXT against Puerto Rico? You're like, that team would never win. Like, that would never happen. We get it, dude. Like, feel-good movie. Becky the Icebox O'Shea. She did it. Great. But it's like, not true. And I'm going to go 90s for one more for you, too. It was also sort of like, do you remember Rookie of the Year when Henry Rome slips on the ball and he's like throwing gas like 105 miles per hour? And of course, the Cubs want to sign a 12-year-old with 104 miles per hour.
Is Doug Etter our Henry Rowan Gartner here?
Thank you. You're getting there with me. We're on the same wavelength. Do you remember we're so far gone.
Who's
Brickman? No, Doug, I don't know. Just barely.
Is Ryan Whalen the pitching coach?
I love Ryan Whalen, so no, pitching coach, yes. Not the, like the crappy wannabe boyfriend stepdad. But Doug Ettert, he does the Buffalo Wild Wings ad. He's all over the place. Henry Rogardner does the Pepsi ad. And then, like, it's the World Series, right? I think they're playing for the pennant. And they lose the fastball, and he's got to throw underhand. I felt today was, like, the underhand throw. It was, like, you blink twice. They're down 25. The magic just kind of ran out a little bit. And North Carolina was the first team that I think looked like a high major team against them. They used their physicality. They set huge screens. The guards came off. Baycott had the 20-20 game. They were knocking down threes. But a credit to everything they ran and the sets that St. Peter's did, that little wheel action where they just wore you out and then hit Edert and he went and did his thing. Incredible. Just that, yeah, the clock struck midnight. The dream is over. But when I saw the emotion on those kids at the end of the game, it was one of those corny sort of internet, like, don't cry because it's over, smile because it happened. Like, you're going to be able to tell that story in bars for, like, the rest of your life. Like, oh, you went to St. Peter's? Yeah, man, we made the Elite Eight, went this crazy run. We beat Kentucky. We beat Purdue. Like, yeah, what are you talking about? Yeah, another round for the boys over here. It's just that's the special part of March, that this stuff never goes away.
Yeah, I mean, look. I almost want to shift to Purdue now.
Yeah, because they stifled them. They did. They clogged the lane.
Yeah. That was incredibly impressive from Shaheen Holloway, that they figured out how to manage those bigs, like just completely crowded them constantly. I wish that maybe Purdue would have made a few more adjustments. Let's say that. I think there were probably some things to be done there, such as like not playing Zach Edey at all in that game. That was not a game for Zach Edey.
Could have gone both ways, though, right? Could have been like the cheat code where, like, when you play varsity basketball in high school and, like, the one Division I kid walks in the gym is, like, 6'9". He's playing a team against 6'2" guys. Like, okay, well, we're in trouble. Like, there was a chance he could have been the cheat code and had a 22-20 game. But early we saw, like, that was not going to happen.
Yeah, completely. Like, I think that you have to give it a shot. I think that their mistake throughout the year, their cardinal sin, was not playing Trevion Williams more. Not starting Trevion Williams throughout the course of the year. But in the case of Edey, I mean, you knew within his first two stints that it wasn't working. It wasn't working the way that they wanted it to work, in the way that he needed to dominate. And by the time that his first stint in the second half ended, he needed to not play anymore. Like, he needed to not be in the game. Like, if you wanted a backup for Trevion Williams, you play Caleb first at the five, not Zach Edey at the five. Mm-hmm. It was a problem. It was a significant problem for them. Like, he got obliterated away from the basket. St. Peter's knew exactly what to run. They ran multiple fun flare actions for Doug Eddard and for one of their other guards. Like, they ran that sweet backdoor lob play. Like, Shaheen was in his bag, just drawing up awesome plays to take advantage of their lack of foot speed in the front court out there, and deserves credit for that. Deserves a lot of props. When it worked for Purdue was when they ran a two-man game between Trevion Williams and Jaden Ivey.
Yeah.
That's what they should have been running all year. Like, let's be real about it right now. Like, that team had Sasha Stefanovic, one of the best shooters in the Big Ten. They had Mason Gillis. They had the other Thompson brother.
Mm-hmm.
They had a couple of other wings that, like, are reasonably good enough to play, at least. Like, Brandon Newman can play.
Ethan Morton,
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ethan Morton. Shout out Ethan Morton, Pittsburgh. Yeah,
had to.
But you have the wings to be able to play a 1-5 high ball screen action. And you have Trevion Williams, who is elite, is a short roll big man, who can make plays passing off of kickouts, or who can put the ball on the ground, who can put his ass into a guy and then really post up and create plays that way if you need the outlet. Or if a team doesn't blitz, Jaden Ivey is an open lane. Like, you're not clogging the lane as much when Trevion Williams is out there, because you have to respect his passing ability. You have to play up on him, because if you don't, he's going to eat up space on that short roll, and then he's going to draw the defense in, and he's going to be able to hit a kick out. It was a real problem that Purdue did not play a 1-5 high ball screen offense throughout the whole year, and it came back to them, I think.
It did. I didn't like Trevion Williams that game. I really didn't like him in the second half. I didn't like some of his decision-making stuff. And I also didn't like him in the post-game press conference saying, like, well, not everybody bought in. And it's like, dude, come on. Like, maybe that's the case. That stuff you keep in-house, he's like, you don't want to go into NBA interviews and, like, you already have that backed up against you. If you're going to be Trevion Williams, probably a second-round pick, right?
Probably a second-round pick. If you get drafted, probably a second-round pick.
Okay, so if you walk in, that's the last guy that's making the team, or he's a two-way, this and that.
And to be clear, say what he said in the post-game press conference.
I don't know. What was the actual quote?
It was something along the lines of, you know, our coaching staff told us that we have to treat this like the best team we've played in the tournament so far, and I don't think everyone did that.
Yeah, not great. You just can't, like, even if that's the case, I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have done it forward facing, especially if you're the 10th, 11th, 12th man. I'm not, have accountability. Call it out in the locker room. Don't do that. It's not going to work in the NBA. I promise you. Like, Jimmy Butler is about to fight Eric Spoelstra. Udonis Haslam's like, no, fight me right here. Like, you don't want that. You don't want that smoke. And especially when I didn't like the two man game with him and Ivy. Like, we're advocating for, they should have done that. I don't think it really worked in the second half either. And I don't.
Oh, I think it did. You don't agree?
Like a little, but not really. It more so I was turned off by, I thought it was a great opportunity when, that's why they play the games, it's not on paper. It lined up. It was like, ooh, this is a run for Jaden Ivey to go on and, like, really be the guy and really catapult himself into that true, like, top 2-3 conversation. I thought the body language and the ball watching after hitting the entry passes and bobbled passes and throwing his hands up, he just kind of went, Jaden Ivey went the other direction for me, and I didn't anticipate that. I thought he forced a lot in the half court. He was 4-for-12. He had 6 turnovers, the most he had all year. I did like some of the laser passes in between the pouts were really good, but I just expected more of him at this time of year.
His body language was horrible in that game. It was horrible, I thought. He threw one particularly where I think that he thought Trevion Williams was going to roll all the way to the rim.
Yep.
And he short rolled instead, because I think that what happened, I don't know this for sure, I think that what happened was Trevion read that the help defender was crashing in. So he read the short roll as the smart move so that he wouldn't get led into a double. But Jaden made the pass into essentially the help defender. It gets stolen. Then he throws his hands up, like, you know, motioning to Trevion like he screwed up. And it's just not what you can do. Like, no. You're supposed to be a top 5 pick. You're supposed to be, you know, regardless of whether or not you're the oldest guy on the team, you're supposed to lead by example just by nature of being the most talented player on the team. And, you know, it's disappointing, I would say, that that ended up being the case, that we saw too many of those moments from him. And it's something that does come up. Like, you watch the tape of him, it happens more than you would like to see when things aren't going his way, I would say.
And more so, again, credit to Shaheen Holloway, credit to St. Peter's. They did this against Ty-Ty Washington, Kentucky. They did this against Jaden Ivey and Purdue. They ran into a wall of North Carolina that ran out a little bit there. They had good game plans, and it clearly frustrated them to the point where their body language stinks. We're questioning, like, their leadership skills. So let's not forget the Peacocks here either.
Yeah, no, I agree. Do you want to talk about Chet?
Oh, we have to. We have to. We have to.
Okay. So Chet Holmgren played a bad game where he had 11 points, 14 rebounds, and 2 blocks.
Yes. that was my closing statement, but I'm glad you opened with it.
He didn't play great. Like, let's just be real.
He was bad. About it, right? He was.
Like, play great against Arkansas. He struggled in the first half, I thought. In the second half, he actually started to get going. He got taken off the court by the officials. Both of the first two fouls that he had in the first half before he got auto benched by Mark Few, I thought that both of those fouls were genuine fouls. I think he thought that both of those fouls were genuine fouls because they showed a close up of his face and he didn't look mad like at the officials. He looked mad at himself.
Yep.
It looked like he was like, I screwed that up. That was on me. The last three in the second half were egregiously bad. Just abysmal. Like, there's no, that officiating crew should be embarrassed by its performance in that game.
Well, they called.
I thought they were disgracefully bad.
Like, Jalen Williams did that same exact, like, drive through your body, like, where am I supposed to go move to Paul Mancaro? And they called it on him or something else. Like, where was that play the game before?
Yep. It was egregious. It was as bad an officiating performance as I can remember in the NCAA tournament against the team. So, and people will come back and be like, yeah, Gonzaga, they only had, you know, one foul called against them outside of Chet, whereas Arkansas had like 7 or 8 called. You know why that is? Because Arkansas plays super aggressively. Like, that's just the way it goes. Yeah. And that's good. Like, Arkansas, I literally wrote about it before the game. Like, I think that part of their goal was to try and get Chet Holmgren in foul trouble, and they succeeded.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
That's what they want to do.
Yeah.
But it doesn't excuse poor officiating because Chet actually didn't do a bad job in that game in the second half.
He didn't. And you know why this is nightmare fuel for me? Is because I'm 2 weeks away from running grassroots events. If you think the officiating is poor in the NCAA tournament, wait till I got to show you what's next, because these guys are coaching our guys. And I agree. I thought it was a little off kilter. But to get to Chet here for a second, if you were looking for warning signs or justifications for not having him number one, this is a great game for it. They're flashing. Yep. Like, here's the problems. Here's what it is. He was the center of that Arkansas game plan to attack him and get it into foul trouble. And I'll credit Eric Musselman for this, too. He's a former NBA coach. His post-game speech against New Mexico State, they talked about defending Teddy Allen like he did with Kobe Bryant. Not saying Teddy Allen's Kobe Bryant. Everyone relax. Yeah. But he said, for scorers, what you have to do is you got to keep them guessing. So maybe for like 5 minutes, you force a middle. The next five, you send a second defender. The third five, you force them left. So you're always kind of like, how am I reacting to this? It was similar to Chet, where it's like, we're going to go right at him. He's going to pick up a couple fouls, and it changes the game. He subbed out. Arkansas immediately goes to a run in the first half. The second half, I thought Chet was a lot more decisive after he scored a bucket, and he was a better interior passer. Offensively, he has to do more when he goes off the bounce and just one dribble, spin back, lead in, or one dribble, spin back, 1 foot, kick out. It's become very predictable. And then I want him more inside the three-point line. There's times where he's just relegated to a trail man, which is okay if you're hitting threes. If you're not, it's just like another guy out there. Defensively, the go-go gadget arms affect the game even when he's not trying to, with some of like the hesitations he has and the lateness that he gets there. So, yeah, the offense, to close this, it took a dip at the end of the year. It did. It's not debatable. Outside of that Georgia State game, I didn't think offensively he seemed like himself. And it wasn't a good game. Despite being so frail and unable to do anything, not enough of a factor, he had 11 points, 14 rebounds, two blocks. So think about that. That's a bad game. Well, I'll be the first to say it. I have first on my board.
That bad was like 22 minutes or something? Like
that's him
minutes?
Getting overpowered and playing 23 minutes. So for the naysayers pointing out the negatives, which is very, very fair, I didn't hear many people talking about still piecing some numbers together in a bad game. And I took some of that as a positive of, if this is bad, how can we make bad just okay? And maybe that's 15, 12, and three blocks, and you're not getting into foul trouble.
What I think that the tournament proved above all for Chet Holmgren is how important the shot is for him. He really has to shoot it at a very high level. He has to be a 40% three-point shooter, I think, to get the most effectiveness out of his ability off the bounce, because he's just not going to have that juice off the bounce. He needs guys to really close out on him hard, and he needs to be a confident three-point shooter. Confidence is not something Chet Holmgren lacks. I weirdly think he got a little bit gun shy on the jumper at the end.
Oh, not weirdly. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. I just don't think that he felt as good about the jumper late in the year. I think it'll come. There's no reason to think Chet Holmgren is not going to shoot at some point. As long as the jumper translates, and as long as the medical comes back clear on him, in terms of the way that his body mechanics work, I mean, look, there's no way I'm going to have him lower than two on my board. I would venture there's a good shot I have him at number one.
Yeah. Still one, okay. but I get it. We're in clouded, a little clouded with doubt.
Okay. Anything else you want to talk about tournament-wise?
Do we do the Jalen Williams thing for 5 minutes?
Let's do the Jalen Williams thing. So I love Jalen Williams.
We had some banter back and forth last night. And I basically said, I don't like this. I get it. I get the charge thing. And it's just become such a celebrated thing where we're talking about how he wears butt pads and falls over and he's all padding. Like, you're not... That doesn't work in the NBA. It doesn't. Yeah. Someone might yell at me and say it does. Try to take a charge in the lane in the NBA, like right above the restricted area. You're going to be in a poster like every single time. You're not taking 60 charges in 30 games in the NBA. It's not. I like his angles. I like some of the passing. I like how he adjusts around the rim. Great Penny Jinx. I texted, he's not really an athlete. And then he had like a tomahawk dunk, like and one or Apollo. Like, that one's for you. Yeah. It's sort of like the Ochai thing. More of a low jumper than he is just an explosive, like in the lane pump fake. Thought he navigated traffic well, but also I thought that he showed that lack of size against Chet, which you can say about a lot of people, but blocked the rim. When you close out to him hard, he's afraid to kind of take that three. Mark Williams did the same thing where he's like, I don't think I'm going to do that. That throws him off. So I know you're higher. So I just want to give you the floor here to give me your sell on Jalen Williams of Arkansas.
So I think I would have him as a top 40 guy. And the reason for that is I think he's the smartest player I've seen in college basketball this season. I don't think I've seen anyone with higher basketball IQ than him. He is absolutely terrific in terms of the way that he rotates defensively. Even beyond the charges, he's always there. He's always available. He's always big, and he's strong enough to hold his ground contesting while moving backward. Right? Like, not necessarily fouling, but staying strong, staying straight up, providing an impediment for opposing players at the rim. I think he is absolutely outstanding defensively. I think he's pretty okay on the perimeter defensively, to be honest.
Okay.
He's better in drop coverage because he's so smart and so positionally savvy and so innately like intelligent in terms of his just knowledge defensively, but I think that you can like run like hard hedges and you can run like flat like coverages with him. I don't think you're going to want to switch him all that often, but I think that you can make it work. And he's so good at like dropping his hips and using angles to angle guys into defenders that you might be able to get away with it from time to time. Like, the key in the NBA, he's going to get locked onto someone and strung out on the perimeter against a guard eventually. It just happens. Guards are too good at it otherwise. I think he's good enough at using his body to guide those guys into other defenders, into the help, that he can make it work. He's an elite level rebounder. Like, there's no argument potentially otherwise. He is an elite level defensive rebounder, probably one of the three or four best in this class. Offensively is where I have my concerns. He's not a great finisher at the basket. He has really good body control, really interesting touch, I think, but he's just not explosive. Like, he is not long and he is very ground bound outside of that one dunk that he had against Paul Bank.
Right.
Every guy who's 6'10" and 240 pounds and a real NBA draft prospect probably has a dunk like that on their tape. The problem is Jalen Williams's true shooting percentage is 53.7%. He only shoots, I think, like 52% from 2-point range. That's the real worry here. Like, can he be efficient enough as a scorer on the interior to make defenders pay in order to respect his passing ability? He's an elite level passer for a big. He's an elite level playmaker. You can run all sorts of dribble handoffs with him. He can reject dribble handoffs and make reads to cross corner kickouts, to dump offs, whatever you're looking for. Right.
Yeah.
The shot is going to be essential for him.
Oh yeah. It's like 26%.
If he can't shoot, he is probably a borderline NBA player. If he can shoot, he might be a low-end starter.
Ooh. Well, a lot of it's come down to the passing, too. And I made the joke that he's Alperen Sengun with butt pads on. Because you also look at – I didn't realize it was this close. Sengun from three this year is 26 for 101. Very small sample, 26% from three. Jalen Williams, total in 2 years at Arkansas from the college line, is 24 for 94, which is 25.6%. So there are kind of like those overlaps and the limited verticality. Sengun's a better passer to me and does a little bit more. But yeah, like I have the same issue with both of them. Like, you're going to have to be able to defend, which they've shown a little bit. Sengun, not as much. But when you don't have the verticality, what else can make up for that at the next level? Like, when he's late to rotate, I think you said he's a good rotational defender. I think so too. But when he's a step late, he's not going to beat you to the rim and then have a block either. So it's piecing all these little things. Yeah.
If he's a step late, he's gone. That's 100% right. But he's not ever a step late, really, is the thing. Like, I don't know. I tend to look, this is my weak spot in the draft, right? I tend to buy into these guys that have like super high feel for the game.
Yeah.
And feel matters, like, just know how to play basketball.
Yeah.
I think he just really knows how to play basketball at a high level. He might be a backup center, and that's why I think 40. But, like, do I think he's a better prospect than Zeke Nagy, who I had ranked, like, 36th in that class? I do, to be honest. I think he's a better prospect, yeah.
Yeah. I think I liked Zeke a little bit more than that. I think I had him, like, late first, earlier second. Jalen Williams, if he declared, I'd probably have about four. I'd have to look, but probably, like, 45-ish or so. So it's, yeah, could be a thing.
Well, Matthew, I would love to talk to you more about basketball in the NCAA tournament, but we talked for like an hour and, you know, 5 minutes or whatever, an hour and 10 minutes, and my internet decided to die. So now we're recording this closing on a hotspot that I've created in my internet. The Australian internet big media complex has failed me yet again for the umpteenth time. Shout out to the lovely people at Telstra.
You're being censored. You're too pro-Duke now. It's the anti-Dukies who are just blasting their laser beams over to Australia to shut down your internet. Your face froze, like absolutely froze. And I felt very alone just staring at the screen, hoping that this wasn't a live broadcast, just me looking at myself. You know, like sometimes you're on the radio, there's like dead air. And that's like a cardinal sin because I didn't have a song like ready to go. It was a lot of dead air. But I'm glad I can see you. We talked enough about college basketball, I think. And
yeah,
we're gonna have conversations in person, which is gonna be really strange for us in 4 days. And I was telling my wife that I've been with my wife for 14-15 years. I never did like the online dating. I was never like a World of Warcraft like put on the headphones guy, like meet your partner they play with. So this is like a new frontier that we actually get to meet each other in person.
There we go. This is beautiful. It's funny. I imagine that what happened is that Tate Frazier heard us say nice things about Coach K and then hit like the execute order 66 to the Australian government and just finished it. And it was like, no, this can't happen.
We had way back in the day where I grew up, there's a restaurant called Christo's, and they had this famous Greek salad. And their campaign, their TV, their ads was they never want to give away the recipe. So somebody be away, about to give away the recipe, and the guy would go to the light and say, oh, no, you don't. Hit the power. And that was it. So I felt like this is a little bit of like a Christo salad recipe for me, too. I was prepared.
The power got hit.
It's going to hit again. We're dashing.
Game Theory Studios here. All right, oh perfect. My god, in my beautiful lovely house, we're losing internet connection again.
You're losing go. Like real time. We gotta close the door, hold the door, close it.
Thank you all for listening. Please remember, rate, review, subscribe, do everything you can to support the show. I think I'm back again finally. Benny and I will be recording from New Orleans at some point. Until next time, we will talk soon. Bye.